Okay, so let's begin. My name is Donald D. Gasper, and I'll be interviewing Charles A. Woodford, a crew member on a U.S. Army Air Force B-17 bomber during World War II, who served in the European Theater of Operations. Today is the 8th of November, 2001, a Thursday, and we're at Mr. Woodford's church in Belleville, Illinois, Union United Methodist Church, specifically. We're in one of the conference rooms here. And this is tape one, side A. And we're beginning this tape at approximately 2:10 in the afternoon. And there may be some background noise. There's some construction going on at the church, but hopefully that won't interfere too much with our interview. And this interview is being conducted as a portion of my oral history project regarding the veterans of the air war over Europe during World War II under the auspices of a graduate level course at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. Specifically, the course is Approaches to Oral History, History 447, for the fall 2001 semester with the instructor, Dr. Annie Ball. So at this point, I'd like to ask Mr. Woodford to say his full name and spell it, if he would, to ensure that his name is correctly noted in the record. And then after he does that, we'll stop the tape and play it back for a sound check. So, Mr. Woodford, if you would, please say and spell your full name.
Charles A. Woodford, C-H-A-R-L-E-S, Albert, A-L-B-E-R-T, W-O-O-D-F-O-R-D.
Okay, very good. And let me just ask one other question before I stop the tape. By any chance, do you know offhand your serial number, or can we...
395-39871.
I guess you know it.
Yeah, you never forget that.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and stop the tape at this point and do a sound check. And stopping the tape now. Okay, well, we did our sound check. Everything sounds good, so let's proceed. And, of course, the very first question, then, is, Mr. Woodford, if you would please tell me the date and place of birth, and then please go on to describe your childhood, where you grew up, your schooling, your parents, leading up to your time of military service, if you would.
Okay, well, I was born the 14th of July, 1922, in Washington, Iowa. I spent my first night in a dresser drawer because they didn't have enough cribs for newborn babies. My mom and dad, we were farmers. They had a farm along with my grandfather and grandmother in a little town called Brighton, Iowa. Probably some of the best times of my life as a youngster. I think that's probably when I became interested in aviation, because I can see today as clear as I could about 80 years ago a formation of biplanes flying west to east over the farm, and that really made an impression on me. I mean, I could hear them and I saw them, and I think that kindled my interest in aviation. We stayed on the farm. That was during the Depression years. I think probably about when I was 7 or 8, my dad had the chance to enter agricultural extension work, a county agricultural agent, so we moved to Sheraton, Iowa. I think we stayed there 2 years, and then we moved to Oskaloosa, Iowa, where I spent most of my grade school, all of my high school years, which I declared my home, you know, until I was discharged from the service. I graduated from high school in 1940. During my senior year, I was taking correspondence course for a aviation aircraft school out in Glendale, California. Upon graduation, we went out to California to Glendale Aerotechnical Institute. I took my coursework there. Then I became employed at North American Aviation, and that's the first time I ever saw a B-25 bomber. And for a young lad who came off the Iowa farm, I think my chin hit the floor because I'd never seen anything that big before. I had a good career at North America, and then I had a chance to transfer to Hughes Aircraft Experimental in Glendale, California. And I was employed there until the 31st of October, 1942. That's when I was sworn into the Army Air Force at Fort MacArthur, California. That was rather a funny experience. I mean, I saluted anything that had a uniform, Red Cross workers, post office employees, anybody that had a uniform. But I took my basic there, went to Lowry Field, Denver, Colorado for armory school. From there to Fort Myers, Florida for gunnery school. I went to Salt Lake City for my basic, and then to Denver, Fort Myers, Florida, then back to Denver where we were waiting assignment for a cruise. I was sent to Moses Lake, Washington. Now, that's where all of the crew was assembled. We were the first B-17 crew to go through our phase training at Moses Lake. At that time, it was just tar paper shacks. There were no fences or gates or anything. It was just a base under construction way out into nowhere. From there, we went to Walla Walla, Washington, where we finished up recruit training, down to Topeka Air Force Base, Kansas, and then we shipped out from Hampton Road, Virginia.
So you say shipping out to go overseas, then to go to your combat assignment in Europe. Well, okay, we're definitely covering quite a bit of ground there. Okay, so you mentioned you grew up in a farm family. So, and you mentioned you're seeing the biplanes that piqued your interest in aviation some 80 years ago. Now, did you have any other family members that had any connection with the military or any service?
No. My dad was in World War I.
As in the Army?
Army, and I had a grandfather in the Civil War, but no, he was in the Army. And
I
think it was second
infantry?
Lieutenant, yeah.
And second lieutenant in the infantry. Of course, there was the embryonic air service in World War I, but your dad wasn't affiliated with that, as you mentioned. He was with the infantry, okay. And your grandfather in the Civil War. Okay, so you were the first family member to get into the aviation arena, shall we say. Okay. And you mentioned how you went, from Iowa out to California. Now, with your the Aeronautical Institute, the Glendale Aeronautical Institute.
Yeah, Aerotechnical Institute. Aero Industries Technical Institute. Yeah.
Now that was your own. That was on your own initiative.
Yeah.
Okay. You.
Well, my folks supported me all the time. They knew I wanted to be in aviation. At that time, I know my dad. Boy, they were really scraping for money to pay for this course and to see that my tuition and everything was paid out in California. But that's where I wanted to go. We heard quite a bit about it, and that's where we decided to go.
Well, now when you say we...
Well, I mean, that's where I wanted to go. Mom and Dad supported me all the way.
Okay, and just curious, I know you're married. Now, I guess I should state as a bit of background that just for anyone listening to this interview, that I've had the good fortune to know Mr. Woodford for some time, thanks to our mutual interest in aviation history. And Mr. Woodford has attended air shows that we have both been at and crossed paths. And in fact, Mr. Woodford also is very talented in terms of his woodworking and other craftsmanship skills. I bought a set of what you might call wing rib shelves, very intricate woodworking skills with putting those together, as well as a lamp made from the piston. Well, how would you describe it?
Well, I think the one you have is a piston from a World War II fighter, a 3350 engine. I would probably assume it's from the Vought F4U Corsair.
I see.
I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
So, just to let someone know that we've had a number of interactions on aviation history, and I hope to capture a lot of what I've heard from him in the past and do justice to this topic and of course delve a little bit more into his military service given the focus of this oral history project. But again, this just bottom line, this is not our first time we're flying formation together, you might say. So anyways, that background aside, let me pick up again. So you moved away from home, from the farm, and went out to California to pursue your interest in aviation technology. And now the North American aviation plant you were working at, again, I'm not sure if I heard.
Well, that was in Inglewood, California.
Inglewood, California.
They were producing the B-25 and the P-51 Mustang.
So you mentioned you graduated from high school in 40, so you arrived out in California roughly when?
About September of 1940.
September of 40 there at North American. And then you were there for a time before you went on to Hughes.
I left North American in 40, I think the summer of 42.
Summer of 42.
Got a transfer to Hughes Aircraft.
And that Hughes, which plant, what location?
Well, that was the experimental location in Glendale, California.
At Glendale. So that was right near the well, of course, you moved to California, you went to the Glendale Aerotechnical Institute. Yeah. That you went to the North American Aviation Plant there at Inglewood, then you went over to Hughes back at Glendale.
Yeah.
But as I recall, you were at Hughes then from the summer of 42 until 31 October 42 when you first swore into service. Okay.
Now, I had a chance to see him four or five times on occasion.
Howard Hughes.
He kept his HR-1 racer. And you know, you were entering holy ground when you went into look at that, but he would come in at some of the darndest times, and the first time I saw him, he looked like a first-class bum. You know, I mean, he had raggedy clothes, not raggedy, but you know, clothes that showed quite a bit of usage. But he gave us we were retrofitting a S-43 amphibian with a different type of engine, and we had a free rein on any ideas that we might have, and we would clear those through with the foreman, and they would check with him about and see what he thought of it, and he gave the okay to go. We had a blank check as far as supplies and materials and everything like that, so it was a great experience.
Now, did Mr. Hughes actually talk to pretty much everyone on the line?
Not that much, you know, I mean, but you know, he was friendly, but just casual. How's it going? What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And everything like that. I mean, it was pretty neat.
So you say you saw him four or five times, and of those times, how much did you actually get to talk to him?
Oh, yeah. He would come
around. All four or five times you got to talk to him?
Yeah, he would come around where you were working, you know, and ask you how things were going, did you need anything or anything we could do, because I guess he was pretty interested in it. I never did. Well, I found out later on what happened to the aircraft we were working on, but at that time, you know, we didn't have any idea. But it was a twin-engine Sikorsky, you know, the amphibian, you know, with the engine mounted on the, I think you're mounted on the wings, I believe. So,
you not only saw him four or five times, but when you saw him, he would actually come up
to each one of you and talk to you. Yeah, he talked with you.
That was great.
And you know that bothered me, because you know the pictures you hear of him later on in life, you know, is I just don't like to read that, because you know I like to remember him the way it was 50 some years ago. You know, when before that terrible aircraft accident he was in. You know, when he was a rational human being. But you know he was nice. I mean, I can't complain. It was a highlight of, you know, my life at that time to meet somebody that famous and flown around the world, set a transcontinental speed record, and here I was, a young 19-year-old from Iowa, you know, being able to talk to him. It was great.
And so he was very approachable, not so intimidating to talk to.
I don't think you ever approached him. I mean, I never did. He'd always mosey up, you know, where we were working and initiate the conversation. So, but yeah, it was fantastic.
Very good, very good. Well, I see, now we started talking about your entry into service here with, you know, going through Fort MacArthur, Salt Lake City, Denver, Fort Myers, and then back to Denver at your various schools. And I want to thank you. I'll be including some copies of some documentation and materials that Mr. Woodford has kindly provided, which newspaper articles, some photos of his wartime period, to try and add to the transcript, add some supplemental material to further detail some of these aspects, the training sites and that sort of thing. Now, when you went through training, how was that? To what extent did you notice losses due to accidents or washout of people that, you know, they didn't quite pass muster?
Well, there were a few fatal crashes. You know, we really weren't, you know, I don't remember that too much. I remember a lot of the horseplay that went on while we were going through our crew training. I mean, it was, it's a wonder anybody ever got overseas, because one of the favorite things was trying to take your plane and put it on the wingtip on another plane and try to flip it, which, you know, isn't too intelligent. It was a lot of fun. I mean, that's when the crew got to know each other, you know. I mean, we learned to work as a team. We knew, you know, got, you know, really familiar. I know what some of their likes were, dislikes, you know, where you wouldn't, you know, you knew when to back off. And I'll never forget my birthday in 1943. They had a bunch of these great big red Bing cherries, you know, that they have in the state of Washington. They had a whole bunch of those on the plane. We were flying a practice gunnery mission. We were so low to the ground that the ball turret gunner couldn't see the fire because the props were kicking up dust. And that's not too smart.
Wow, you were practically cutting the grass.
We were just about ready to plant corn. But it was great. I mean, you know, we were young. We didn't have any responsibilities. A pilot was married, you know, but the rest of us were all single. And it was just a good time.
Well, now let me try and understand here. The first time that you were introduced or started flying on the aircraft that you served in during the war was at what training base?
That was at Moses Lake.
And that's when you first got introduced to the B-17.
Yeah.
And that is the aircraft you flew all your missions
right.
on. And so that's where you started flying with the crew that you would go into
right.
combat with. So this was roughly, I'm trying to get a sense of the timeline here. You first became assembled as a crew roughly when?
I think that'd be April 42, and then we left for Topeka, or we left for Hampton Roads, Virginia. I think we went overseas, I think, in the latter part of July.
July of 42.
No, that'd have to be 43.
Oh, pardon me.
Yeah, 43, yeah, because...
You're right.
Yeah.
That's right. You were saying you got into service in October of 42,
yeah.
So, right, we want to make sure that,
yeah.
get those years straight.
I think we probably had about 3 months of crew training.
Where you got to work together, know each other, yeah. fly together, all that, prior to going over to, excuse me, the fighting off a bit of a cough and cold here, before you got to go over to the theater of operation.
Yeah.
And you said there was some fatal crashes, but not too many.
Not that I remember, no.
And your training, pretty much from day one, you knew you would be serving as, well, what position?
Table gunner.
And so therefore going to armor school. Now, they also gave you some flight engineer
yeah,
training.
But my primary duty was tail gunner. And we were supposed to be familiar up to a certain point with every other position. You know, in case one of them got hurt or seriously wounded, you know, somebody could fill in on a temporary basis, the man the ball turret, or maybe help out in the radio room or something like that.
Was there, let me put it this way. As I understand it, the top turret gunner was normally the primary flight engineer.
Yeah.
So is that to say that with your training, your flight engineer training, that you would be his backup, or were other crew members given the same lever?
We had two on our crew. We had another waste gunner that was also assistant engineer, and myself. And either one, I think that was not normal.
There was only one other person trained to be the backup to the flight engineer if the top turret gunner was
same
disabled.
Same with the radio operator. You know, you had a primary radio operator, and then you had a backup.
On your crew, who was the backup?
Radio operator?
Right.
Al Reed.
Well, what position was he?
He was a waste gunner.
I see.
Yeah, both the backups, Smitty, he was a waste gunner. He was an assistant engineer, and then Al Reed was a backup on the radio. And I don't know why they had me as a backup, too.
Now, when, of course, you know, you were in the training phase, and then eventually you got into the combat phase of flying in the B-17, would you say there was any consensus of opinion among the crew members about whose position they considered to have the hardest time or maybe the most difficult position. I mean, many people, when they go see a B-17, they think of the belly turret gunner. Oh, that poor guy had to really be scrunched up in that little ball turret.
Yeah, I can cover that now, or I can cover it later. I flew one mission in a ball turret, and I was never so lost in my life because you didn't have any reference point. You know, what they'd call himself a fighter at 3 o'clock or 6 o'clock, you were swinging around on that thing. And
Now let me understand. I mean, it's quite obvious, anyone who sees you, that you're a very tall, a relatively tall individual. And let's see, you stand, six foot?
6'2 and a half.
Now tell me, getting into a ball turret at 6'2, how did that work?
I operated cross-legged.
Cross-legged? Yeah.
That created problems. That created problems, too. I mean, I was never so glad to get out of that thing in my life.
Now, you said you flew a mission in the ball turret. How many hours were you so confined?
I don't remember what the target was, but most of the missions, they would be maybe 6 or 7 hours.
So,
from the time
were in that ball turret for 6 or 7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I bet you were a bit, had a cramp or two getting out.
Boy, I flew two missions, my first and my last one, in the ball turret. I just wanted to see what it was like.
The very first one you flew in the
ball? It was about our fifth or sixth mission, after we were...
Fifth or sixth, and then did you say your last one too?
Well, no, I mean, I never flew a ball turret again.
I heard that first and last, writing some notes down, I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so...
No, I don't think any position, a lot of people think the tail gunner, that was the worst spot in the plane. I don't think it was any more dangerous than any other position, because... you were subject to flak or fighters, no matter where you were. And I think they were all equally the same as far as danger goes.
As far as danger. It's just the ball turret gunner tended to be the most, perhaps the most cramped, everyone would say. Yeah, he's wadded up pretty good.
Oh, he is too.
Yeah. So you shipped out to Europe in July of 43. How did you fly over then? Or?
No, we went over on troop, on a convoy.
You went on a convoy?
No.
And did you incur any U-boat attacks?
No, it took us a long time to get over there because the convoy couldn't go any faster than the slowest ship. And I know we did a lot of evasive action, zigzagging and stuff like that.
But your convoy of, you remember roughly how many ships were in the convoy?
No, I sure don't.
Okay, but no U-boat?
No, not that I'm aware. We had some alerts, you had one funny incident happen. I know it's kind of pathetic. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but we had one crew that his pilot was really mean. And they told us, word got around, if he's ever caught out at deck at nighttime, he won't get to where we're going. And he didn't.
Oh, really?
I don't know whether I should mention that or not.
Well, it's hard to say what might have happened. Exactly, yeah.
I think everybody knows.
Now, so you went in the convoy. Do you remember roughly did it take you? How many days would you say?
25, 26 days.
26 days by convoy.
Yeah. We docked at Liverpool.
You went. Was this from New York to Liverpool?
Hampton Roads.
That's right. You did say Hampton Roads to Liverpool. And they didn't fly you over there because...
Well, I don't think at that time the routes had been established, where they used to go up through Greenland and Iceland. I don't think they started flying bombers over until later on. See, this was in 43, and I don't think they started ferrying planes, a crew's taking their own plane over until later on in the war. Probably maybe 44, latter part of, first part of 44 or sometime.
Okay, and then... at that time, then, you were, of course, then in a combat unit. Now, what bomb group and squadron?
Well, they assigned us. First, we were assigned to the 100th Bomb Group.
The Bloody 100th.
Yeah, and we were lucky. We didn't realize how lucky. And on our way to the 100th, they changed our orders, and we were assigned to the 388th Bomb Group, Rectangle H at Nettleshall.
Could you say that place again, or could you actually spell it if you...
Yeah, they changed our destination to the 38th Bomb Group at Nettleshall.
Yeah, and that base is what again? Could you spell it?
Knettishall, maybe two L, I'm not sure. It was a little bit north and east of Cambridge, around Bury St. Edmunds.
North and east of Cambridge, around, what was that,
Bury? Bury St. Edmunds, B-U-R-Y, S-T period, E-D, M-U-N-D-S.
Okay, that was the 388th Bond Group in what squadron?
Well, I was with the 561st.
561st?
Yeah.
And that's the unit you flew all your missions with, and did you fly all your missions out of that same base?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the Rectangle H.
Rectangle H, that was the identification on our rudder and on the wings.
On the rudder and the wings, yeah. And so, as you've mentioned, the convoy left in July of 43. It took almost a month. So we're talking, end of July?
Yeah, 43? And see, we had to go through training. You know, we had quite a bit of flight training. We had to go to the place called the Wash for gunnery. Some more gunnery.
I'm sorry, that place was what?
The Wash. It was called the Wash.
The Wash?
Yeah. It was, I don't know, it was a mess. It was on the Channel side of England. That's where they had all the crews went for gunnery training. I guess more sophisticated, up-to-the-date training, you know, as far as aircraft recognition and stuff like that.
Well, now, how did the training differ between stateside and over there in terms of targets used or any other ways?
I think it was more intense. I mean, it was more up-to-date. You know, they had more information on the fighters that were likely to encounter, you know, what their weak spots were. We got our gunnery training fine-tuned, you know, as far as deflection, you know, length of burst and things like that. I mean, it was just a more or less a refresher course because, see, we'd been away from them for probably about 2 months, probably about a couple of months, you know, before we were actually going into combat.
And in training, did you get to train on 50 caliber machine guns?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you ever train on 30 calibers?
No.
Always from day one, you always use 50s. And did they do anything to reduce the amount of ammunition used so that, like, for example, in fighters, somebody might have a fighter plane that has 6 or 8 machine guns, but they might only allow them to use 2 machine guns as they their strafing runs. And was there any way that they tried to conserve ammunition use or anything?
No. I mean, especially in combat, I mean, both my containers were full.
Well, in combat, I wasn't sure if in training they cut corners, so to speak.
Well, no, we might have been limited to, I'm not sure, but we might have been limited, you know, to how many rounds we could get off. I mean, I really don't know.
Okay. Now, did you ever fire at any, I recall reading that certain aircraft, P-39s, were plated where they would allow frangible bullets to be used. Did you use those?
I don't think that happened until later on in the war.
Okay, so you were, by and large, say, firing at towed
targets and stuff like that, yeah.
And was it usually just, what was usually towed?
Well, it was a sleeve.
Just a
sleeve? Yeah, a sleeve on the cable, yeah. And then I think every so often we had bullets with grease paint on them. You know, I think every 51 was grease painted or something like that, and they can tell, you know, if you had any strikes or hits.
On those sleeves, thanks to the grease, every nth round or so. And so, yeah, we went through this training at this location they call the Wash for some reason.
Yeah.
Okay. And now let's see, to kind of give a sweep of your combat time, you ended up flying how many missions?
11.
11, and as I understand it, of course, thanks to our previous interactions and some of the materials you provided today, you got 11 missions in when on the 11th you suffered a serious injury.
Yeah.
So it just before we get to the final mission, I would just like to hear, so the first combat mission would have occurred roughly when? What month?
Probably about September. The first one was to Reims, France, R-H-E-I-M-S, France.
Reims, France,
yeah.
And that target was what type of?
I think it was marshaling yards.
Railroad marshaling
yards,
okay. And that would have been September of 43.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, let's just say in those 11 missions, roughly, I think you mentioned it already, that typically they were 6 or 7 hours.
Well, yeah, some of them were longer. I know that the time we went to Gdyni, way up in Poland, I think that was about 11 or 12 hours. I mean, that was the longest one we ever pulled.
11?
I'm pretty sure that's way up there on that'd be the Baltic Sea, or maybe way up north.
Could you say that location and maybe spell it?
Yeah, G-D-Y-N-I-A. It was a seaport, harbor transportation for the supplies coming into Germany.
Up there on the Baltic?
Yeah.
And
that was a disaster because we had to go to the target twice.
Oh my.
And the second time they had us, they had our altitude, and we did a 180 and came in upwind, which slowed you down quite a bit, and they were really tearing us to pieces on that one.
Well, I should say I had a little bit of time in the Air Force, about 8 years, although I wasn't an air crew member. I do remember hearing some of those folks I know who flew on aircraft, that one of the cardinal rules in combat is, as they tend to put it, one pass, haul ass.
Yeah.
That you don't want to go over a target twice, if at all possible. So that on that mission, you said it was a disaster. What kind of losses did you incur?
I think we had, I don't know, our group, I think we had, I know two of them aborted and headed for Sweden, and I think we had three that were shot down.
Mm.
But just out of our group. Now, I don't know what the whole lot, what the rest of them suffered.
Now, you served during a very intense period of combat because, of course, as I've read in some books, that in the latter part of 43 was really when the air war over Europe was in large measure determined, especially as our heavy bomber formations had to often go into deep targets unescorted.
Right.
So to what extent of your 11 missions did you go unescorted?
Well, all of them, really.
I imagine you had some short-range coverage, and then the fighters had to turn
back.
Yeah,
we could have Spitfires that cover us maybe about 10 to 15 minutes inside France or inside the channel. And because that was before drop tanks and belly tanks, and they had to turn back, because of fuel supply. And the Luftwaffe was aware of that. So they held their fighters on the ground or maybe in the air, waiting until the escorts had to turn back, and then they'd come in on us.
So all your missions only had very limited escort, and then it was pretty much you're all on your own with the guns on board the bombers. You never really had a chance to have a fully escorted mission with the drop tank equipped P-51s or any other aircraft, since your last mission occurred before all that had come to pass. Now, what would you say was your typical targets?
Well, it would depend. The Schweinfurt, we did the Schweinfurt raid, that was a ball bearing factory.
You were on the Schweinfurt raid when 60 bombers went down?
No. And
that was...
That was in 43, I believe. Bremen, we hit Bremen three times. I think that was the... factories and I really don't know what the targets were. That was one place I hated because, that flak there was, you could get out and walk on it.
Bremen was a pretty tough go.
I was lucky because I didn't have to look at it. When I saw the flak, we were through it.
In the air, since you were in the tail.
And then we flew one really tough mission to Durren, D-U-R-E-N, and I don't know where we dropped our bomb because we didn't hit the target. The recon planes went out and the target was still there, and to this day I don't know what we bombed.
Well, you said it was a tough mission.
Well, I was just kidding, tough. It was a... So somebody fouled up and got lost.
Oh, a foul up, and it wasn't so much that you got mauled.
No, it was just somebody got bombed that shouldn't have been bombed because we didn't hit our target. I don't know what we hit.
So you mentioned Your first mission to a marshalling yard, the very lengthy 11, 12-hour mission to the seaport on the Baltic. Of course, the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt. Bremen, a very well-known seaport.
Yeah, I think that's an industrial area,
And industrial area, yeah.
Then we hit marshalling yards, any city that had a war, where a lot of war effort or where a lot of war production was going on.
Well, now, of course, especially that Schweinfurt mission is almost in any book on the air war in Europe as one of the most demanding, bloody, and any number of words can be ascribed to that mission. That given the loss of 60 aircraft and on a percentage basis, what tremendous losses there were. What else might you want to add about that mission? Your experiences in flying that very famous mission.
You're just awfully glad you got back. I mean, it was. It was a total disaster because the Luftwaffe, of course, everybody knows now. They brought down their fighters from the north. That we were under constant fighter attack from the time we got in till the escorts left us until we got back to the coast. And it was just strictly every bomb group and on their own defensive firepower.
So, to what extent did you find that your group? In going on the Schweinfurt mission, did you manage to have a relatively less harried mission in terms of other groups tended to get bounced more? You just happened to be fortunate that in the bomber stream you didn't get maybe as much attention?
I think a lot of our group's success was the tight formation we flew. I mean, they stressed that tight formation, which was your best means of defense, and we really flew tight formation. Some of the other groups would get spread out, and the Luftwaffe would come right in on them. They'd start working away at the tail end, Charlie Purple Heart corner, work their way up, and just a good tight formation was the best thing you could do because you were pretty well covered, and of course you were still going to have some losses. There's no way in the world you're going to prevent losses, but we came through Schweinfurt. I think we only lost, I think, three or four planes that day.
Out of how many you put up?
I think we had 24. So, I mean, we came out of that in good shape.
Now, of course, again, that was a very pivotal time of the air war, and with air superiority being fought for by both sides very strenuously, and still there were, of course, many high-quality Luftwaffe pilots still in the force before they started suffering such disastrous losses themselves with the introduction of long-range escort fighters that could accompany the bombers throughout their mission and take the battle also to the German airfields and try and shoot them down, shoot them on the ground, or as well as hit the factories that made the planes, and then also eventually the fuel lines, the fuel supplies that made the Luftwaffe a force. But I guess at that pivotal time, my question would be about the defenses. To what extent did fighters and flak, how did you view them in terms of what concerned you the most?
Well, the flak did, because you couldn't do anything about it. Fighters, if we would see that, Goring's Yellow Nose, that was a crack fighter outfit. If they'd come in, at least we had some twin 50s, that we had something in our hands that we could do, we could take some action. Going on the bomb run, you just had to sit there at a certain altitude, a certain speed, and you had to take the flak. I mean, there wasn't a thing you could do about it. But the fighters, at least maybe we were successful sometime, but at least we had in our hands a couple of 50s, at least I'm doing something. I'm not sitting there not doing anything.
Of course, the tail position, you had twin 50s.
Right.
And, without going through each crew position, I mean, of course, the waist gunners, they had usually single 50s. Did you ever fly with, I believe it was called the YB-40, which was a more heavily armed version of the B-17, kind of a gunship, you might say?
Yeah, they weren't. I don't think they were flying when we were doing our flight.
Never with your group?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'll say one thing. These liftoff pilots were good. I mean, they were brave because, you know, you come in, tail end on a plane, you'd have 2, 4, 6, you could possibly have 7 or 8 guns just from one plane firing at you. And if you've got a whole group, you know, at you, you know, I mean, there's a lot of lead coming your way. And they didn't back off. I mean, they came right through the formations from the tail, and they'd come in head-on attacks. No, they were brave. They were good.
Now, when you talk about what all, you know, you were dealing with the defenses, and of course the 11th mission was very difficult because of your injury. To what extent did you find that you, in the other missions prior to the last one, that your aircraft got shot up and you know, they were counting holes when you got back to base?
Well, I think we took flak on probably about every mission but two. I don't think we picked up any flak on our first mission, and the time we went to Durham, we didn't pick up any flak. But you know, usually there was a few holes, maybe there were quite a few, you know, depending upon, you know, where you happen to be at that point in time.
Did you lose any crew members in any of the flights?
No. You mean on our crew?
Right, your crew. No, nobody took a fatal shot through those missions. Okay. Now, of course, with these defenses, the prospect of being shot down was very real. How did you view your prospects of, Let me just before I get into this question, I think maybe I'm going to check the tape. We may be running just about out. Let me double check here if I can reach over and see where we're at. Looks like we might have a couple minutes or so left, but let me go ahead then and press on with this. Maybe this one more question, and then maybe we'll stop it. What did you view as your prospects if you would get shot down for POW treatment? Did you feel like you would?
Well, when we were there, the life expectancy, we didn't find out until we got actually flying combat. 3 missions was the average expectancy. I don't know, every one of us had probably our own thoughts, you know, whether we were going to make it or whether we didn't. We didn't talk about it to each other. I think you more or less kept it to yourselves, you know, that you were awfully happy to get back onto the ground after you got done with the mission. You know, that was one more step closer to getting home.
Because at that time you were obliged to serve 25?
25 missions, yeah.
To what extent, with, you know, the losses you had then, did you run into this feeling of an empty bunk syndrome, you might say, where you every time you come back it's like, well, you know, these guys aren't in the bunks, or these guys aren't at the mess hall, or was that pretty much every mission you had that sense of, oh gee, those guys, they caught it today? Or
I'd probably say about half the time, yeah.
About half the time it was very noticeable.
No.
Yeah.
You know, we had one thing happen one time that I've often wondered about. We had one young lad, he wanted to get out of service and he wanted to go back to Texas and be a sheriff. And we thought this one night, we knew we were scheduled to fly the next morning, and he went around the barracks and gave away all of his personal effects. You know, we thought he ready for the R&R. And you know, we had that mission the next morning. I forget where it was. One plane got hit and one person was killed, and that was him.
And maybe he had a premonition.
He had to have a premonition that because you know, we were really thought, you know, he'd gone a little bit off the deep end, you know, I mean, too much combat.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, I'm just going to check the tape one more time here. Yeah, I think I might as well shut it down so I don't make a habit of stopping this or looking at it all the time. So we're going to stop it here and flip it over.